Hi, this is Carson Block of Zeros TV, and I'm very pleased today to have as our guest Dr. Pascal Stroying. Dr. Stroying is the founder and owner of a company called MetaShort. And MetaShort is of particular interest to me because it's an independent firm that critiques activist short reports on behalf of its clients. Pascal, welcome, and thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
So the first thing I want to get into is an understanding of how your business works. Like, what type of investor or firms come to you to critique activist short reports, and how does that process work?
The general idea behind it is, like, especially on the beer side, there are big struggles to do the due diligence because the important information, some of it is in the short reports, some of it is in the media by journalists. Some of it is much more hidden somewhere in the internet. Some of it comes from whistleblowers. And to really do a proper due diligence as an investor, or also from the legal side, if you have a case in front of you, you would have to dig through, in many cases, hundreds of sources. And what I try to do is just compiling them in a very concise manner, in a very readable manner, maybe similar to what banking analysts try when they dig into an equity and publish a recommendation about an equity. But I fear this, or not I fear, but I'm pretty certain there is an issue with incentives on the side of many of these reports. I think that you cannot do good due diligence. And we have seen this repeatedly in many cases of big frauds, from incidents in 2008 with Lehman Brothers, earlier Enron, right, quite recently Wirecard in Germany. It's kind of the analysts probably miss a spot here and there, and it's often a very important spot. And I try to make it readable and also evaluate the short reports with this. So when I write my reports, I base what I write, or I quote the short reports often, and many times it's like you find something very well-founded, very good research in short reports, but sometimes also there are just overemphasized allegations that should not be made like that. Yeah.
To make sure I understand correctly, your process, one of the first things you'll do if you're engaged to look at a given short report is you'll look at the sources that the short report cites, to evaluate whether those sources are supportive of the statements in the short reports?
Yes, but I wouldn't say this is the most crucial point. I don't think it happens very often that there are lies in the short report when it comes to the evidence. I mean, yes, yeah, there are lies, but they are not fabricated evidence. I don't think that's happened very often. But what happens very often is an allegation like this company would go bankrupt, or this company had fake cash accounts, and there is no further evidence on this given in the short report. And that's, of course, not very good and very fair. And what I find surprising often, might be other points that are very important in the short report and good research. So I sometimes wonder, why is it that you have to add some extra allegation, right? You can fairly say this stock is highly overvalued in the market without making allegations that go too far and say this company has to be bankrupt.
Yeah, look, I mean, those are, you know, that's a fair criticism. And I don't read a lot of other short reports or short activist reports, but when I have, I mean, yeah, I've felt like there's a range of reasonableness, especially in the US. It's important that we distinguish, you know, in the EU too, you distinguish between statements of opinion and statements of fact. So I think normally, you know, if you're concluding that, if you're stating that you think the business is going to go bankrupt or that there's fake cash, you know, those are really, I would think, de facto statements of opinion. But they really need to be reasonable and drawn from the facts that you present. How big a problem is this, do you think, where you have these big, bold pronouncements of opinions, but you don't see the facts that would really support those opinions?
I think it's more in an issue of rhetoric and how you present it. And this is what I try to address with MetaShort. If you are not used to the business of short selling and have these kind of reports in front of you all the time, it's hard to read those. And I see this very much reflected, especially in the German media, where there is a lot of fallout from Wirecard, right? This was a very big story in Germany, not only because the company was decently sized, or for German standards, it had a big size, but also it was kind of a story of a tech startup being a young company, and the German industry is particularly old. They have a lot of competitive companies that are old, and there's also a lot of criticism about do we have to refresh our industry in this sense. What I see in the media, even in media that is well-funded and should have the abilities and the resources to put some proper time into their reporting, they are not capable to see through the rhetoric that you say. When I say, we believe, in a short report, it says, we believe these accounts are made up and there's actually not this cash of, let's say, $1 billion. Is it like a 20% degree of belief, or is it like a 90% degree of belief? And most people who read this kind of reports and are not used to it would assume it's like a 90-plus percentage degree of belief. Then if someone writes in a management summary, we believe that, blah, blah, blah. In reality, it can sometimes be probably less than 50% or something. And it's a whole other issue, but it's also very important that in short reports, many of the allegations rest on an analysis of non-financial technology. For example, what is the product? You see this a lot in these pharmaceutical cases. In engineering cases, usually the short seller relies on expert judgment by some of his whistleblowers or consultants or whatever. And there also sometimes goes something wrong. I mean, it can happen that you just have the wrong consultant on the engineering part. And then that's a very crucial and important point. Yeah. And maybe it's also important that everybody knows that even inside science and inside engineering, there is a lot of debate even among the top experts if something can work out or not, right? It's not always so as clear as a Theranos, but that's the reason why something like Theranos happens, is like even the best experts can be wrong, right?
Right. Well, my approach to those situations that you're talking about where there's a technology that's really at issue, I've always said, hey, you know, we could trot out our scientist who says this doesn't work, and the company will trot out its scientist, which would say it does work, and the shareholders are always going to believe the company's scientist because they want to. I mean, when you publish a short report, I mean, really, you're speaking to the long holders of that stock, and you know, they want you to be wrong. They want to find excuses to disbelieve you. For me, the way to handle those situations, and we haven't done that many over the years in which we're saying the technology doesn't work or the drug doesn't work, to look for behavior patterns on the part of the management. So if you look at the history of the CEO or the controlling shareholder or shareholders, you know, if there are problems in their history, whether it's with this particular company or other companies, you know, then I think you can start to build a basis to infer that the scientist or scientists, ideally, is the short activist. Hopefully, you're not going to just one technical expert, but you're going to multiple technical experts. And if you're finding more or less unanimity among those experts saying there's a problem with this, and you map that on top of what you think are real credibility issues of the people on the other side, then to me that seems like it's in the abstract. That seems like it's a valid short case, because you've got valid reasons to say, yeah, this company is problematic. That scenario that I just outlined, I mean, how do you read that on your end?
Years back when Elon Musk had his plans to build a landing rocket, one of my engineer friends, who was like deep into rocketry, said, no way, never works. If I talk to other people, it is really, really, really hard to do. And somehow they managed to do it. So I did at the university philosophy of science. And one of the approaches there is this Bayesianism that you talk about. You never talk actually about facts or truth. You talk about degrees of believability or degrees of belief or the degrees of validity. Then you can try to build up some kind of measures, construct some measures where you say like, okay, let's talk about smoking. Is smoking bad or is smoking not bad? And then we have like 10 expert studies and 8 of them tell me smoking up is bad. Then I can kind of rate the experts. The one might be somehow has different incentives because the study is funded by this side and the other study is funded by the other side. And that's exactly the core argument why I want to do this meta short approach. These kind of meta studies are studies where you incorporate all kinds of available information, measure them, rank them by importance, validity, or whatever, and then try to come up with some kind of the best possible story. For example, in the case of a farmer short, the best possible story is like, okay, with a degree of belief of 80%, this product will not work how they explain it, or it will have much more risk when using it or something. This probabilistic approach about on thinking about things, you can also just easily apply to whatever you do in the financial markets, because financial markets are also best explained probabilistically. There you can just say, okay, if my degree of belief is at 90%, my short bet or whatever bet I want to place is very different and with a very different risk management than when I do it with a degree of belief of 60%. But still, if you think it's 60%, it still can be a bet you should take, because if you have like 160%ers, then on the long run, you will converge to a profit, right?
That looks at a subset of short activist type research. I mean, to me, the bread and butter short activism research isn't forward-looking. It's not usually trying to figure out whether a drug works or will work or technology will work. It's usually more, at least our approach is, you're looking backward. And the way I put it is, there are three questions that we're asking. Has the company accurately disclosed or explained material information? So, or another way of looking at it is, have there been lies of commission? Has the company disclosed all material information, especially that which could be adverse? So lies of omission. And the third is, does the market understand what the company has disclosed? If we can answer no to one of those three questions, and usually if you answer no, you're getting, you know, no to, you know, two to three of them. But if we can answer no to three of those questions, there might be something for us to do. You know, what I try to emphasize when I talk to people, and this is the way that I've written most of our publications, is we're looking backward, and so we're saying, well, when they told you X, this was a misrepresentation, or maybe it was a lie. You know, this is the truth here. They didn't tell you why, blah, blah, blah. And basically leave it to the market to try to extrapolate what they think this company is going to do in the future. Very little of what we do, I think, is forward-looking and is making arguments about the future. It's really arguing about the past. And so you were talking about degrees of probability, or, you know, likeliness, or your probabilities of truthfulness. I mean, to me, and maybe, look, because I wear the hat of a short activist, maybe I your perspective and my perspective don't agree on this, but to me, a lot of this is factual. Like, you know, if I write A happened, well, is that true or is it not true? Am I right or am I wrong? And so I'll write A, B, C, D, E in terms of facts. Therefore, our opinion or our conclusion based on these facts is X, Y, Z. Do you think that's a good approach, or would you still look at that and say, well, you're saying that these are facts, but I don't know that we can say black or white, this is true or not true. I'm still looking at it and putting probabilities on what you state are facts in the report.
Yeah, I tend to... which is also like a stance in the philosophy of science, which is not like a must do. It's like a position one can have or not have. And what you described is I would model it in a sense with very high degrees of belief, because, for example, you can also have things like you look up a certain individual, you find out very incriminating details about this person, like online or with a detective or something. And even there, things can happen, like you mix up the name or something, which actually happened. But this is like, in some scenarios, you are to 99.9% right. But I think it's important to never, like in your thinking, close the doors for a certain proposition that this is true and cannot be changed. I mean, for example, in legal matters, it's just a little anecdote, but I saw a presentation from a lawyer who was just starting out. He had to defend as a free defender. I don't know how it's called in English. Like an homeless guy who was allegedly stealing in the shop, right? And the allegations were made by three employees at the shop. And years later, he saw the same people again, and he found out that it's a common scheme that these guys just, if they find an easy victim, just steal the groceries. And and basically no one in the jury in this case was like on the defending side for this homeless guy. So it's just a little anecdote. It can be that something looks very, very, very much like something, but it isn't this. But it's perfectly fine to say, like, I'm sure with 99%, and I am willing to make a bet in the financial markets on this, because I believe on the long run this will play out in this way.
And I understand what you're saying, but to me it's still, these are binary questions, right? The short activist is either correct or they're not correct, right? So they either got the right person, or, you know, whose history they cited, or they got the wrong person. And mistakes can happen. There are situations in which I have read activist short reports, and it's either been accepted publicly that there have been some problems with the report, or there's a perception that there are certain problems. But a number of times I'll look at those reports that are controversial and maybe, you know, kind of lower quality, and I'll say, well, they got certain points wrong, but directionally they seem like they're correct. Meaning overall there's problematic behavior by the company management or problems with the accounts, but, you know, maybe they've identified the wrong issues. How often do you see reports that you think are probably directionally correct, but have issues with the construction of their arguments or the facts, versus reports that you think are likely directionally incorrect and just completely off base?
I would say most are rather correct than incorrect. And I would base this on the just the legal risk you face if you just make wrong allegations. This is kind of a incentive mechanism, I would say. So I mean, I have not seen, or I would say it's quite rare the case that a flourishing, good, unproblematic business faces allegations, but this happens as well. I mean, I remember a case years back on AMD. They were making like the CPU, the big computer CPUs, and they were on a oligopolistic race with Intel for years and decades, and Intel was always like the premium choice. AMD announced they had like a new kind of architecture, a new idea, and they believe this could be a hit in the market, and they could finally catch up or even be better than Intel in the markets. And there was some short allegations against AMD, and their product worked out wonderfully. And on the long run, they kind of the stock was a 10 bagger. The sales numbers are good, and I even had to test the product myself. So I'm fairly convinced that this is kind of one case where you really, something like this happens.
What's interesting about that, and so I actually had a little bit of a front row seat to that one. So it was a cybersecurity vulnerability. So it was the AMD's new Ryzen processor. And the idea was, at that time, Intel had just had a major security vulnerability affecting pretty much all of its processors that had been discovered. And so the bull thesis on AMD at that moment was Intel's got this problem with vulnerability. AMD has this new Ryzen processor. So AMD's going to take server market share from Intel. And we evaluated the vulnerability that was cited. It was originally discovered by an Israeli cybersecurity firm called, I think, CTS. And we found that the vulnerability is real. You know, to my recollection, there was no overstatement of the existence of the vulnerability. But where my jaw kind of hit the floor was, I believe that the activist who published this wrote, therefore, we think AMD is a zero. And we knew this thesis. Like, we believe there's a cybersecurity vulnerability. We thought that if that really were known, that that was a good counter argument to this view that, hey, they're going to steal all the or take all this market share from Intel because Intel's not secure. But I mean, never could I have in good faith thought that that would take AMD down anywhere near, you know, to being a zero. So, you know, but so to me, that was an issue where, and it's tough, right? That's an opinion that, so I think the facts were largely correct. Like there's a vulnerability here, you know, the exploit exists, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that was a really tough one. And I have to say, like, that got a lot of discussion at that time in the activist short community, because a lot of us were sitting there like, really? Like, you know, and you can never prove that somebody made, I think it's very hard to prove somebody made a statement of opinion that wasn't in good faith. But I would say that's as close to a situation as I've seen where, as a short activist, I'm like, I don't know, man, like that's really at maybe even over the line. So I'm you know, I maybe similar, you know, view than, you know, as to yours. But for me, I was fixated really on that opinion, that statement that it was therefore going to zero, which it obviously didn't.
No, it did not.
You know, if it was an honestly held belief, it's, then, you know, it's an opinion and it just happened to be wrong. And look, I think for short activists as well and short sellers, since the global financial crisis, it's been really tough because things that you know, that we think should matter, we find out post facto, you know, after we, you know, point these out publicly, we find out that investors in some cases just don't care. They don't matter. I was speaking with a professor who's based here in Austin recently. And he's somebody I hope to actually interview as well. And so he's done research. He's done a lot of academic research into activist short selling. And one of the things that he found is that I think a pretty significant majority of the time that a short activist says, okay, you know, we're short XYZ, it has whatever problems, that the stock goes down over the long term. So, you know, and on an alpha basis, that's got to be real alpha since the market, you know, pretty much does never, you know, never goes down. But that the degrees by which it goes down are usually a decent bit smaller than what the short activist will say he or she thinks the, you know, it's going to. And now I was a little surprised on one hand, because I feel like a lot of short activists don't put price targets on companies. We've occasionally done like valuations, you know, where we're saying, okay, well, like in Group Casino, there were publicly traded securities. So we said, okay, if you add this up and subtract the debt at the parent level and, you know, you throw a multiple of blah and parent EBITDA, this is what you get. It wasn't a target price, but it was kind of a sum of the parts valuation. But I was surprised. He said that a lot of short activists actually do put target prices on, and that in his, you know, in his impression is that they're directionally correct, but that there's a magnitude of overstatement in terms of the profundity of the short thesis, which, you know, I'm curious as to your thoughts on that. I had an explanation or response that I gave that professor, but yeah, I'm curious as to what you think of that and if that kind of jibes with your observations.
Two points on this. So the first is, yes, I agree price targets are fairly stupid. And I say it with emphasis with these words, because I mean, there's so much contingency in the market overall. If your price target is zero bankruptcy, okay, that might be a valid price target, but everything between I have a beer issue and zero is very unreasonable, because your insight in the company is very limited. Even if you did some fair due diligence, and that's the reason why banking analysts have the habit to say like hold, sell, neutral, and that's it, right? Because everything else is hard to do. Usually they should even sell wholesale neutral in comparison to the market or in comparison to the industry index or whatever. And the second is I totally agree. What I usually say, and what also I aim for this market, but usually like the more active fund managers and legal experts are more interested in what I do, but I aim actually for something like a pension fund, yeah, who has a very, very long investment horizon and a very low activity actually. They can profit most from short reporting and from meta short, because they can increase their alpha by getting a bit lighter on the usual candidates in the short sphere, because the easiest way to make money from short sellers due diligence is not going into the stock, and it in comparison to betting on its decline, which is highly risky, as you know.
Right. Yeah, no, definitely. And to emphasize that last point again, my view has been that when we speak, we're speaking to long investors. We're not speaking to people and saying, hey, you should short this, because that's a very individual decision. And very few people out there in the markets are equipped with the kind of risk management discipline and, frankly, pipes that you need, you know, in other words, institutional execution capability that you need to do this. But yeah, it's so, and what I was going to say is my view when I heard that from this professor, said, well, look, the thing is, when you do what we do, we're very cynical, right? Like as short activists, I mean, to us, the notion that there's an efficient market, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, we think every tick of, you know, almost every stock proves otherwise. But so I said, I think there's a, you know, there's a tendency for us to basically overestimate the value that investors will put on our findings. Now, that's certainly not always the case. I mean, there's a stock we shorted a few years ago, NMC Health, that went to zero really quickly, that, you know, we didn't think was a zero. It just had a lot more fraud in it than you know, we could imagine. As short activists, I mean, we really don't know, like, how is the market going to value these things? And that's why I hate answering that question. And I have to say, German media has been, they're really persistent in asking that question, you know. So for example, several years ago, when we shorted Ströer, we didn't put a target price or valuation on it. All we said is, hey, like, these are problems with the information that's been disclosed. You know, we don't think this, you know, the organic growth rate's accurate, blah, 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 blah. And I kept getting this question from reporters, well, what's it worth? Like, I don't know. All I can tell you is that the information that they put out, we think, is really misleading. So what's the real information? I don't know. And even if I knew the real information, you have to kind of be a psychologist, you know, a mass psychologist, to say, well, with this new information, what's the valuation the market's going to put on it? Maybe this is most profoundly true, or it's most profoundly evidenced when we look at U.S. listed companies from China that have some degree of fraud. They're almost all structured as VIEs, variable interest entities, meaning that you, as a long investor, you don't actually own the operating business. You own a company that has a series of contracts with it. Basically, you own a derivative of an operating business. And so people will say to me, you know, for example, Tal Education, before it imploded, you know, we showed that there had been fraud that had been committed. They faked a disposal and reacquisition of a business in order to take a gain on sale that wasn't really a sale, and then lock it in. And and they did something similar with another transaction. People ask me, what's it worth? I don't know. If you ask me my view, okay, what would I pay to own a derivative of an operating business who has a management that's actively lying to me? My answer is zero. But I recognize that there are a lot of people in the market who aren't that dogmatic and would say, well, you know, I'd pay something for that, for a derivative of an operating business whose management is lying to some degree that we can't determine. I'd pay something for that. I think that that's why, as a short activist, it's not a good idea to put target prices on. And if we do put target prices on, it's like almost witchcraft. I mean, how do you really figure this out?
Yeah, as I said, I totally agree. Price targets are not a good way to publish research results. I think it is used as some kind of rhetoric, right? I mean, if you put out a price target, suggest to your readers a price target, but not actually make a forecast, right? So it's not about forecasting, but I would completely omit publishing any price target, because also it makes you look a bit silly to the sophisticated market participants. But I'm also not very skilled in influencing the not so sophisticated market participants, which is actually what you need to do if you speculate on short term market activities. And I totally agree on it's very, very hard to forecast what happens. If we look at GameStop and these kind of stories, it's kind of you cannot bet with arguments on this. So I also always say try to create your alpha as a long in a very long run, even if you're bearish on certain titles.
Yeah. Yeah, and now the other thing that I think it's worth pointing out, and I will do this from time to time, I will refer to a company as a zero. That when I say that, I mean this thing like is valueless. I've been doing this too long to believe that means it goes to zero or goes to zero anytime soon. You know, and I'm fond of joking that 700 million is the new zero, because there are companies out there that we know are zeros, you know, that there's just no value there, that trade from market caps north of 700 million. Or you could even look at like Lordstown and Nikola, those have like $5 billion market caps. And, maybe that's the new zero. But looking at Wirecard, there were people who said that out loud, that's a zero. And after they said it, it hit, I think, 33 billion euro peak market cap. GSX, a China-based fraud, which we published on, that thing hit north of 30 billion market cap, I think, twice after several of us had publicly come out and said this thing is valueless, it's substantially a fraud. And, I think I even called it a king zero, I even have to make up new terms to describe how shitty some of these frauds could be, so invent this king zero nomenclature. The funny thing, our view inside Muddy Waters of sell side target prices is that a lot of times it's backfilling. So if an analyst, who's got to be, bullish on the stock because his job basically depends on that, puts a price target of $20 on it, and when it's at 10 and it gets to 18, like the price gets raised to like 28, and there's no real change. It's just they have to backfill to, increase the target price to meet, to be something that's higher, it's significantly higher than the present, just because they want to maintain a buy. My favorite example of the corruption of this on the sell side was Snap.com. So Morgan Stanley led the IPO. And as soon as they were able to publish research, the analyst came out and put, whatever target price that was much higher than the IPO price and then current price of the stock. And he did it based on discounted free cash flow, which is like really a joke when you think about an early stage tech company like that, that you're expecting to do this. But putting that intellectual dishonesty to the side, he had his discounted free cash flow model, which yielded target price of whatever. But then he realized that he screwed up the taxes, and that actually taxes were going to kick in much sooner. And so it lowered like the year four, year five cash flows and the terminal value, of course. So in order to avoid dropping the target price, he lowered the discount rate in order to come out to the same target price. And his explanation was, well, you know, the higher discount rate reflected unknown risks. And now the unknown risks are known. It was the tax thing. So now that we know, you know, we can pin the tax thing down more, it deserves a lower discount rate. And yeah, I mean, that's the magic of sell side target prices. You know, it was in stark display there. And I mean, to my mind, that's the sort of thing that I think SEC enforcement maybe could have even made a case on. Like, how can you say this in good faith? Because it was so out there publicly, and just the idea that you would lower the discount rate, you know, after you found a major error in your model, it, to me, is, you know, outlandish. But in any event, that's, you know, that's kind of the land of target prices.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, I would say, like a common approach in many areas of the financial industry. In my earlier life, I was I did risk auditing in banks, especially in the derivatives. And you can change your burden, your capital burden, quite a lot by making tiny tweaks in the quantitative analysis here and there. So I would even say this is kind of a core competency people look for when they when they need quantitative analysts in banks.
Yeah. Exactly. So we've talked about some of the things that make for bad short activism or things you look for, but on the other side of the ledger, what do you think is really good quality short activism? What do you look for?
I mean, the thing is, more research and better research is always better, but there are also like constraints, timely and financial resources, right? You cannot hire like 100 special consultants giving you 100 different expert opinions. I think one of the good strategies is like keep looking at where you have your personal competency in looking at. So usually it's kind of accounting analysis, financial reporting analysis. Rather try to find a few very, very important points and do not deviate so much into a long list of points where you think there are allegations, there's fraud. Really try to focus on a point that is hard hitting and where you have very strong evidence, and don't waste much time on anything else in there. And from what I observe in the market reaction, at least the sophisticated investors kind of react appropriately to it. They kind of if you have GameStop and Nikola, whether Robinhood crowd is in it, and I always wonder where they have their money from, or if it's kind of some smarter hedge fund managers front running everything or so. I mean we all wonder that. Try to lower your work burden when you do a short report by focusing on the important points and not so much by making a long list and many pages.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you make that point, because that's something that we learned the hard way, I'd say, starting in 2013, 2014. One thing, as I started my short activist career in 2010, and where the human attention span was then, which I didn't actually think was remarkably good at that time, I mean, it's a fraction of that today. And people just, I mean, back in 2010, we talked about how nobody read anything. And after we published, this was 2011, we published on Sinoforce, I held a conference call. I remember one person called in, he was pretty hostile. And he seized on this comment that we'd made, with that was kind of snarky, about comparing the GDP of this province this Yunnan province to Shenzhen. You know, he's like, what do you think? What is the GDP of Shenzhen? How do you know? And I'm like, listen, man, it was. And then he cut me off, and he's like, what is your edge? What's your edge? And I just kind of lost it. And I was like, my edge is I read, we read, that's our edge. And I felt that at that time, like, that's a huge edge in 2011. If you read stuff, because I felt not a lot of people were. But you fast forward 10 years today, it's interesting that you have this service where sometimes buy side investors come to you and ask you to evaluate the reports. I'm under the impression very few buy side firms, especially the ones that own these stocks, read much of these reports.
I talked to a lot of fund managers with different levels of activity when it comes to management, like highly actively managing companies and like the common pension funds or whatever, who have kind of very highly diversified large portfolios. Yeah, only the very top tier in activity are the ones who really read this kind of report, read your reports or would be interested in my reports. There is some kind of aftermarket, right? When the securities fraud cases come in, then the complaints have to be written and a court has to decide to, usually it ends in settlements for reimbursements to the shareholders, like pennies on the stock, pennies on the dollar.
Mostly goes to the lawyers.
Yeah, a lot of that goes to the lawyers, yeah. there these reports will be actually read because there's a struggle about, or this is fight about the defendant side and the plaintiff side. We have to consider that the internet changed a lot in the last 10 years, right? It's kind of, you find very many services about information condensing, ticker kind of services. It's kind of, I also feel like in society overall, the focus on reading or the length of pieces that are read kind of changed. I totally agree. Only the very top level of people thoroughly read, which is also explained by it's so hard to get to create alpha. Probably there are the people who try who really read a lot, and there are the people who don't even try it.
and honestly, the people who don't even try it probably outperform in this market the people who actually read. And you know, it's funny, I had a conversation recently with a very well-known venture capital investor. He's been doing VC a long time, and I asked him, I said, how many analysts do you have at your firm? He's like, we don't have any. Do you have anybody underneath the partners? It's just a handful, small handful of partners. He's like, no, we don't. Like, you know, what would we do? You know, these companies are 3 years pre-revenue. It's not like we build models, you know, we just basically, you know, so I asked, well, how do you make your decisions? And he's like, well, you know, like you want to feel like the business can scale. So we have to see that there's a path to that doing that. But basically, can the CEO sell? That's kind of, you know, like even with a public equity, that's maybe at the end of the day, you know, all you really need to do is, does this guy seem like he can sell? And now that he's public, is he, you know, inside the box enough that he's not going to Adam Newman me, you know, like Travis Kalanick kick me, you know, and like drive the, you know, train off the tracks, basically. So if the CEO can sell, and especially if this thing is going to get into some indices and get passive flows, and I don't think the CEO is going to do anything really stupid and derail it, that's probably all I need to know to outperform, truth be told. You know, maybe that's overly cynical, but, you know, I feel like that's the battle that we fight as short activists, is just the apathy to, you know, to risk and, you know, to things that we think matter.
Was this individual long on Theranos or?
Actually, no, it wasn't, okay. Wasn't in Theranos.
That would be a context, yeah. Example, right?
But, yeah, I mean Theranos was one that actually, there were sharp people who knew something was wrong. Not just people who knew from a technological perspective that you could not miniaturize all of these tests, you know, in one device. I mean, there was that group of people, but there were venture capital firms and potential early round investors who said, well, I see that Elizabeth Holmes has collected some, you know, impressive sounding names, but none of these people know life sciences well. So that was the tell for, I think, at least for some investors who stayed out, because they said we would have expected to have seen, you know, these life science, top tier life science VC investors in this thing if it were real. And a lot of people forget that Theranos was operating that for, a number of years before they really were able to raise real money and they hit their inflection point and took off. But then again, you know, many people were blinded by the collection of names, you know, the former general, I forget which general, and, you know, George Shultz, and, you know, who it's like, he might not even know what day of the week it is, to be honest, you know, like no offense to him, but yeah, there were people who were impressed by that.
Would you say it's easy to find for a long investor with such a view to find the point in time when to get out? I think that's also fairly hard in many cases, right?
Another venture capital investor, friend of mine, Josh Wolf, had a great Twitter thread on this just a few days ago. He was asked by Anthony Pompliano, known as Pomp, who's in crypto. Pomp said to him, like, push back against one of Josh's tweets, saying, you know, well, you talk about, like, Josh had tweeted something about, like, the cult or religion of Elon, I think, and Pomp pushed back and said, nobody has a bigger religion around him than Warren Buffett, and they call him the Oracle. And so Pomp made a few points there. Josh responded with this long thread about what's the difference. And he talked about when Berkshire Hathaway years ago had purchased, I forget which business, but, you know, for a small amount of money, has had to put very little money, a See's Candy, put very little money into it over the years. It grew its unit sales at a relatively slow clip, maybe 2% per year, but the dollar value increased a lot. And it threw off so much cash and enabled Warren Buffett to buy more great businesses with that cash. So he said, Josh said, that's a great business. And that's why, you know, you can look at Warren Buffett and say, you know, this person deserves, you know, at least some of the hype. But he said, what passes for investing today is mostly you have to have a belief that somebody else will have a belief that somebody else will have a belief and so on in this narrative. And at the end of the day, like, it's not, hey, I believe this is going to become See's Candies and throw off a bunch of cash and be the sustainable business. It's just, hey, I believe that there's a greater fool down the line for quite some time who's going to buy into this narrative because you've got a CEO who can really sell, going back to that point. You know, and that's, as Josh put it, and I agree, that's what so much of long side investing has become this, you know, today is just, will this narrative hold long enough for more people to be taken in by it? And so if you're asking that question about when long side investors get out or do they know, I don't know, man, like what, you know, like these, you know, these companies and these people have auras around them until they don't. And you saw that the auras around Adam Neumann and Travis Kalanick crumbled very quickly. So I'm not really sure how you hedge that risk or how you anticipate when that's going to happen. I mean, a lot of these CEOs are relatively young. They've become billionaires, multi-billionaires on paper. They have access to whatever aircraft they want to charter. And they become, if they didn't start out, they become spoiled children very quickly. So how do you know when that catches up to them?
I would wonder how venture equity investors do this. I mean, I just had the idea that you can do some kind of sentiment check on social media. I mean, you have like these large accounts and then you can probably with some keywords check or something, try to make some kind of analysis that kind of rates them where the tipping point is with Adam Neumann, for example. I mean, how he's perceived, but it doesn't even have to be the trigger moment for the big money to go out, right? That's another issue. Probably it's like how it happened often in investment that like the important people call each other and decided.
Right.
Probably. I don't know.
Well, in the case of Adam Neumann, right, like that years before they attempted to go public the first time, I was reading articles about this guy and, you know, and he's talking about we're changing the world through running a commercial rent arbitrage, you know, and he'd have these, you know, he'd have these gatherings and get up there and extol the virtues of veganism, you know, while being known to order meat occasionally. I'm looking at this guy and I'm like, this dude is so full of shit. And I think people knew he was full of shit. It's just when did that matter? That's actually something I wrote in an investor letter, my first ever, several months ago. And it really got to that, which is, you know, Elon Musk is a serial liar, but he's done the core things. He's held his core. He's made good on his core promises. I'm going to build the car. I built the car. I'm going to build the rocket. I built the rocket. We're so accustomed, like we live in a world that is constructed. I mean, a lot of the building blocks that are in the foundations of our world today, I think, are bullshit. But, you know, it's really figuring out like when too much bullshit, you know, when it's too much versus when it's the right amount. I think that's kind of that's the challenge. Like that's what today, you know, what investing is. And my, you know, the point that I make about activist short sellers evaluating technology companies, you know, bringing us back to something we started off discussing is, again, like we can't look at the technology and know. For various reasons. I mean, you know, again, our scientists say this, but, you know, like everybody told, you know, Elon Musk that he could never land a rocket vertically. You're right. But we basically are trying to figure out how full of shit is this management team? Is it just the right amount of bullshit that they're actually going to be able to deliver on the core promises? Or are they just so far beyond that, like so out of their league from an operational perspective, just so full of shit that they're not going to be able to deliver on those promises. And that's when I think you have to look at behaviors, like in the case of Nikola, rolling a truck down a hill, you know, and saying, you know, and then, you know, answering that, well, we never said it was under its own propulsion, you know, like rolling a truck down the hill, the CTO having been, you know, having had a contract or a concrete contracting company, you know, right before becoming the CTO of this supposedly cutting edge technology company. Like, to me, that's what you have to look at. And it has to be just egregious in order to say, yeah, these guys are not Elon Musk's. They're, you know, just guys who are just, you know, completely full of shit.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to do. And finding the tipping point is really, really a challenge and depends on the business.
Well, listen, Pascal, it was great speaking with you. I'm glad that we had the chance to connect. I hope that a lot more people in America are going to become aware of your service, because I get the impression that, you know, you're best known in Europe right now. But I think it's very valuable. I would love to see more long-oriented institutions read activist reports. But in lieu of that, engage somebody such as yourself to evaluate them and discuss, you know, what you think the merits or shortcomings are. So it's a very interesting business. And as a short activist, thank you for doing it. It's great to have somebody out there as kind of a neutral arbiter. Thanks for coming on the show as well, Pascal.
Thanks a lot. It was a good talk. Thank you.